This is a UVic RUSI oral history interview with Mr. Barry Phillips, recorded on November 14, 2008, in Victoria, BC. Mr. Phillips is being interviewed by Katrina Gower about his Army experience with the 4th Canadian Mechanized Brigade Group in West Germany from July 1967 to August 1971. Mr. Phillips is now a retired captain. You enrolled in the military in September of 1961 when you were 19 years old. What prompted your decision to join?
I had always had a military interest, I guess. I enjoyed it. I had been in, the school that I went to and graduated from had a school cadet corps, which you had to belong to. And I enjoyed the activities. In the summer months, we were sent off to, or we could go off to, a cadet camp at Vernon in BC. And it was very well structured, very well organized, challenging, physically, mentally. People shouted at you when you needed to be shouted at. And I just thought the experience was good. I then went into the militia, the reserves. That didn't last very long because at the same time I applied to the military, to the Reg Force. And I was accepted into the Reg Force. So went directly almost from reserves into the Reg Force as a young officer cadet. I've done some genealogical research on my family, and as everybody, as far back as I can trace, has always been in the military, with the one exception, which is my father. And he didn't serve in the military only because he'd had rheumatic fever as a kid. He had a very weak heart, which ultimately killed him. But he's the only one that I can find that did not do military service at some point or other, either British or Canadian.
Interesting. Prior to serving with 4CMGB, what did you do in your time in the military?
Well, the training started for me in a place called Camp Borden, which is north of Toronto, near Barrie, Ontario. It's a big training center, still is, a huge training center for the Canadian Forces. So a year of military officer training there, and on graduation I was posted off to a field unit in Winnipeg, trundled across the country in a train, which is how they sent us from one place to another in those days, which was kind of fun and interesting to see the country that you just didn't really have any appreciation of before that. And when you go across the country on a train, you really get to understand just how huge this and diverse this country is. Anyway, 2 years in Winnipeg, which in, where I got into the airborne game, falling out of airplanes, a lot of work in Rivers, Manitoba, and then off to places like Wainwright, Alberta for huge concentrations, military concentrations. And after that, back to Camp Borden as an instructor this time. And I was there for a couple of years as an instructor, platoon commander for young. We used to have a program in those days called Apprentice Training Program, which was you've got young kids who had completed grade 10, basically, across the country. And they were brought into a 2-year program where they received academic, half of the training was academic to bring them up to a junior matriculation or grade 12 level, and the other half of the training was the military side of things. So I was brought in to teach these young kids what the military was all about. And as a side issue here, my future brother-in-law was one of the school teachers, teaching them the academic side. We were both single at the time, living in quarters, and I guess one Christmas he took pity on me because my family was out here in Victoria, and I knew I was going to be able to get home. So he took me back to his home in Ottawa for that Christmas. I met his sister, and that was the end of me as a single guy. Not too many, I think maybe a year later we were married, and then almost immediately after we were married, I was posted off to Germany for 4 brigades. So when I arrived at 4CMBG, I was a brash young lieutenant, soon to be a captain, newly promoted and newly married.
Wow. So First MGB was your first overseas experience?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Well, sorry, it was my first experience as a posting. I had been sent overseas from Winnipeg for a small, about a two-month tour to help the units that were in Germany rotate out and another unit coming in. So they used to send some of us in to act as umpires to allow these units to rotate in and out of Germany. So I was very happy to be going back.
Great. So was there a specific training process before you went over for forcing?
Not really. No, the training that we underwent in Canada geared you for what you were going to be doing in Germany. The only thing about Germany is that it's a much higher level of operational readiness and a much higher pace of operational training and deployments. So the what I had done in the field, the units in Winnipeg, prepared me for, and that was a two-year tour, that prepared me for what I was going to be doing in Germany pretty much. And then again, what I did in Cambodia, the military training and reading that you were required to do. We had to write things called promotion exams. As a young lieutenant, you had to write a whole series of things called promotion exams, which required you to study every aspect of what it was in the military, from military law to tactics. And so I had to write these. I wrote lieutenant to captain. And while I was at it, I decided to write the captain to major exams right after. So by the time I got to Germany, I was qualified academically, theoretically, that they could, it was just now going to be based on my performance, whether or not I would reach the dizzy heights of major.
Okay, interesting. So what do you think, what the skills you learned in Canada, what were the most important ones when you hit Germany?
Well, field operations. You had to know, you had to have experience in command at that junior level, because you were responsible for a platoon of, you know, let's say it's approximately 60 soldiers, and some of them were very, very experienced. Your old warrant officers and staff sergeants and things like that, that had rows of medals, looked at you and cut you about the ears because you're just a young pup. But you had a lot of young kids as well. So your ability to command respect or earn the respect is more the better way to put it, of those people who are already in Germany, already at that operational level, already at that pace of training. You had to come in running, and you had to earn their respect pretty quickly. Well, the training experience that I had prior to that allowed me to do that. Some of the people in Germany that already knew me, or knew of me, from what I've been able to do in Winnipeg and at the school and board. So that, I suppose, was the unwritten part that you had to be able to show that you could lead. You're a young officer, you better be able to lead. I don't want you to sit up here following us around. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that you needed to know was the operational tactics at that level. What it was, your platoon, what your platoon was tasked to do. You had to know how to do all of the things like ammunition dumping and delivery points and movement control and technical road movement, no lights on in the middle of the night, and map reading, and all that sort of stuff that you need to be able to survive in the field. Field craft. I mean, I'm throwing out terms here that mean a lot to me, but probably just, I'm not sure what to do. Was that something like a hobby? No. Field craft is your ability to survive and live in the field, sort of thing. So if you came in with that sort of experience and background and training, and you already had the knowledge and experience to be able to lead, then you're accepted. A young officer or even a young soldier coming in that hadn't learned that yet didn't survive very long at 4CMEG. Simply because you had to come in knowing what you were about to do. Mm-hmm. In those days, you know, we took our role very seriously over there. Anybody that went into that NATO environment, we were up against a pretty ferocious and large beast, and we didn't know then how the future was going to play out.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't all that many years before that we'd been at each other's throats in Europe. So we took everything pretty seriously, even young 19-year-old kids and seven younger. We knew we were there for a purpose, and we had to at least show that we were ready and as professional as any other force. In fact, the Canadians, because we were simply a brigade, as opposed to the Brits who had a corps, which is many brigades, or the Americans, which had even more, many, many, many more brigades, and the Germans, everybody else. We had to show the wave of flag, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the Canadian Brigade made its name on its professional capability and abilities to do things better and faster than anybody else. I don't want to blow my own horn, but I think we did a pretty good job because everybody else practiced what we did in the field. They said, watch what are the Canadians doing?
Mm-hmm.
And they go and copy that. So it was good. We had a very rich, prestigious and important role to play within the British Corps as well, initially.
Mm-hmm.
We moved later after the American and German sector, but we were so good. I shouldn't remember things now. We were so good that when we used to have the big multinational exercise that would play out across the whole of West Germany,
mm-hmm.
within the British sector, the north of Germany, the Canadian Brigade was always played part of the enemy force. Well, they didn't know what to do with us otherwise. I mean, we were the largest, most coherent, most capable unit within the whole of the British sector. So they say, okay, well, let's put the Canadian Brigade right up against the East German border, and then we'll attach in some Dutch and some German folks with them to make them a little bit bigger, and then we'll say, go. And then we would pretend that we were Russians and try to break through.
Yeah.
And we'd run right across Germany, right over to the Dutch border. So, I mean, the exercises were huge, but there was always the Canadian role to play the bad guys.
Yeah, I actually
noticed that. So it was very exciting because you then had to study the Russian tactics and find out, mm-hmm. Okay, well, how would they do this? Or how would they try to do this? And so that's what we would do.
Mm-hmm. Fit into their minds a
little bit. Well, we got to the point that we would take our helmets, take the metal part of our helmet off, and just have the helmet landed there, which if you turn it backwards, looked sort of like a Russian helmet. And we'd put red stars on the front of our helmet. We'd take our combat jackets off and just wear the padded lining for it as a jacket. So it had that quilted...
Mm-hmm.
Russian/Chinese look to it. We try to look the part of the Russians. So we took it to great lengths. The Brits always used to just say, you Canadians, your guys are crazy. Stop it, you're driving us nuts.
Excellent. Now, when you were serving there, did you serve with anyone who had served in the Second World War? Is there anyone?
Yeah, I had a couple of soldiers. My staff sergeant, Sandy Trotter, had been with the Devil's Brigade. I had gone into the airborne game when I was back in Winnipeg. So I was always doing push-ups and all the sort of things that airborne warriors are supposed to do. And he used to match me. This grizzled old guy who was about as big as one of these chairs. And what really used to annoy me is that he could match my push-ups with one-armed push-ups.
Wow.
He was extremely fit. And certainly his knowledge of field craft was second to none. He was just a great guy. I mean, the rest of the platoon just loved this old guy. But he was a Second World War soldier. Of the very best kind, really. He wasn't into the business that we were in that he had sort of come to in at the end of his career. He'd been in the infantry, so he was Iron Corps. There were still, you know, there were still a couple more like him in the unit that had, you know, had the rolls of medals. We had a lot of Korean veterans, mm-hmm. certainly serving with us.
I'm just wondering if there was any difference in attitude or perception of Germany and Germans between generations, or not generations necessarily, but those that served in the Second World War and those who were sort of new.
I guess there would be. I mean, it would be natural to think that a fellow that had fought against the Germans mm-hmm. and seen many of his friends killed by Germans would have a different attitude towards the local Germans that we that had just come in would have. We found that it was an interesting, you talk about social differences as you went from one side of Germany to the other. Some of us, when we got there, moved onto what is called the economy. In other words, you lived in German homes with them. Put you up. Others lived in married quarters, apartment blocks, sort of thing that were taken over by the Canadians and nothing but Canadian soldiers in them. I was fortunate. I ended up on the German economy. And in the 4 years that I was in Germany, I moved five times. Different circumstances. Sometimes because my unit moved from one place in Germany to another. Bugs. But every time that we moved into with a different German family. We always found them to be very hospitable. The last family that we lived with, after we moved down to Lahr, we moved out into the southern German countryside, little village called Kaltoff. Moved in with this German family. He was an older fella, and with his wife, a couple of dogs. He never had tenants in his home before. But he took us in, and they just became like parents to us. They were just so fond of us. And when we found out that Eleanor became pregnant, we had our first son in Germany. That's why we called him Mark. I always joke, Deutsch Mark. But he was born over there. And when the landlord found out that we had a son, it was just like it was his grandson. He put his arms around me and grabbed me, and we went off to the secret place in the forest where all of the rest of them used to gather and wouldn't allow foreigners to come in and share a beer with them. I was waltzed in, and he was screaming at the top of his voice that my Canadian has had a boy, a son. Yeah. So everybody cheered, and the beer flowed. It was it. I felt I was with family. When we went on exercises, and as I said, we backed ourselves right up against the East German border, the Germans there would treat us like gold, because they could see what was on the other side, mm-hmm. and knew that we were there to mm-hmm. and trained to try and protect them. So instead of going into little tents and hovels and living underneath trees and all that sort of stuff, no, you're not going to do that. You bring your troops and you're going to sleep in our barns, in our homes, in our basements, in our attics. The troops were treated extremely well, the closer we were to the East German border. And then when the exercise started and we swept our way across Germany, went right over to the other side of Germany, the further we got away from the border, the more hostile the Germans became. Because as far as they were concerned, all we were doing was interrupting and interfering with their daily life. Mm-hmm. And who are these people breaking down fences and running across our fields and making our streets dirty and making loud, rude noises in the middle of the night sort of thing? Mm-hmm. So they became a little less friendly towards the NATO troops. We were treated differently, though, from the Brits that we were exercising with. Brits were treated far more harshly by the German population than the Canadians were. Canadians seemed to be loved wherever we went. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd pay for our damages. If we damaged somebody's fields or his crop, then we would pay for it. I think many of the British contingent still felt that they were at war, and they treated the Germans with equal disdain as the Germans treated them. But the Canadians were different. We sort of said, forgive and let's get on with it.
And do you think that had something to do with being a smaller force, or was that just the way...
I think it's just the Canadian attitude. Yeah. The Canadian attitude was, okay, well, why are we here? Well, we're here to bring peace to a very, at that time, unstable part of the world. Mm-hmm. And so these guys are who we're here to help. So let's not piss them off, pardon my French. Yeah. And that was a sort of attitude that prevailed. I can't even remember what the question was, but we sort of remember
about it. Oh, well, it was an interesting answer, nonetheless. Just moving back into the beginning days, actually, of Force MGB, there was a bit of debate over who to align the Canadian Brigade with, and eventually wound up being with the British initially, and then with the move south, aligned with the Americans. It sort of leads me in the area of Canadian military identity and how that was established. So what, for you, did it mean to be a Canadian soldier in West Germany?
I think, we've spoken to that a little bit already, mm-hmm. this morning, but being within the British sector was relatively easy. Most of our tactics and strategy, after all, we've been part of the British Army right from World War I. Or even before that, the Boer War in South Africa, we had been part of the British Empire. First World War, part of the British Empire. Even though we fought eventually as the 1st Canadian Corps and had that Canadian identity finally came out in the First World War, the same held true later on in the Second World War. We fought as the Canadian Army and had that national identity. Elements of the things still were aligned with the British, mm-hmm. larger umbrella. The forerunner of the Canadian Airborne Regiment was the 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion, and it was part of the 6th British Airborne Division, and it fought with the parachute regiments of the UK, rather than with the American 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions. We were just more naturally aligned with the British. We were still, you know, part of the mm-hmm. British Empire.
Yeah.
So it made sense for us to be with them. It was no surprise to me that we were in the British sector when I went over to Germany for the first time. Where else would we be? Wasn't mm-hmm. in my mind. The fact that we had a Canadian identity within the British Corps was something we were proud of, and we worked hard to make sure that we were as good or better than anything else they had in the British Corps. Mm-hmm. When we moved south, it was the geographical location that we went into that was dictated where we would line up with. The problem for us was that we had two roles. One role said that we would go and fight with the American Corps, and the other thing that could have happened, depending on what the bad guys did, is that we could have gone and fought with the German Corps. So it was a very complicated time for Canadian Brigade, where at one time we knew exactly what we were supposed to be doing when we were with the British. We knew our role inside out, exactly where to go. When we were in LAR, it was very difficult because we had to study two different tactical strategic games, the German game and the American game, and how we were supposed to fit into either one of them. Mm-hmm. And we were a new identity as far as they were concerned as well. I mean, the Americans knew us as that funny little gaggle that lives up in the snow, mm-hmm. north of us someplace, north of Chicago. So what the heck are they doing here, and just how good are they? Well, we didn't really have enough time to prove how good we were, but we knew we were much better than they were. The German looked at the Canadian Brigade from the history of the Canadians in the First and Second World War, where the Germans when the Canadian Corps moved into their sector, they knew that their game was up because the Canadians were going to get them. And that was the mindset of the Germans when they were facing Canadians. And that continued on in the Second World War. Canadians earned that reputation of shock troops type of thing. So when we went into the German Corps sector, we were treated very reverently. Well, where can we put you on? Would you like to be in the center? Would you like to be on the left? Would you like to be on the right? Mm-hmm. Whatever you'd like. We know wherever we put you, we know it's going to be solid. So we lived on our reputation much more so with the Germans than we did with the Americans. Americans didn't know what really we were about, because the Americans are Americans. The Americans take America with them whenever they go.
Well, sort of along those lines, you've already covered it a little bit, but how generally were you perceived by your peers? It sounds like with a lot of respect. And
how was I personally?
Or the brigade or anything.
Oh, the brigade had earned, before I got there, a heck of a reputation. You make a reputation in peacetime on your ability to deploy quickly in an exercise and to react quickly under exercise situations. So we would be in our garrison. We invented this thing called the snowball, and we practiced it religiously. Snowball was a deployment exercise, and it usually happened at dark 30 in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning. And what would happen is garrison troops would get in their trucks, vehicles, and fan out all across the German countryside where the Canadians were living and on the economy in these little towns and hamlets and whatever around the garrisons, the forts. And they'd go through the streets just beeping on the horns. And you can imagine a truck's big air horn going off. If the whole town wakes up, and Canadians are at it again, you'd be sound asleep and you'd hear the horn, snowball, and instantly you're up and you're into your gear and your combat's on, and the rest of your gear was already in the camp, out in the street, hopping into the back of the trucks, off you go into camp, and the whole idea was to get everybody in, get all the equipment up, loaded with your operational loads, and out and go out into by convoy into the deployment area. And we had to be able to do that within 6 hours to get everybody up and everybody out and deployed within 6 hours. Wow, we could do it within two.
Wow.
And some of the Germans really got into the game. They thought, hey, the Canadians are at it again. The lights had come on all over town. They're all out waving flags and cheering us, running out into the trucks, and you're waving goodbye. It was like a game. It was kind of like a game attitude about this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Not everybody cheered. Not everybody likes getting woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning. But so we earned a heck of a reputation. We practiced. We drove ourselves to this sort of capability. And then when the British or Americans or whoever was umpiring a big fallout deployment, they would come and watch us, and they'd all leave and we've got some work to do back at wherever they came from. Nobody could do it any better than we could. And then when you get into an exercise situation and you're up against somebody else who's trying to break you down, the Canadian ability to move, do road moves at night without lights, was really good. I can think of one exercise. I think it was called Rob Roy or one of those things. Anyway, there we were backed up against the East German border, and I'm sitting on the radio net waiting for code words to come through saying what's happening. And I'm listening there, I hear a code word. And then I hear a few other things that come across the net, and I realize something's happening very close to us. So I came out of the op center and I grabbed our CO and I said, come with me. And we hopped into our Jeep and we went down to this little village that we were just parked up outside of, pardon me, sort of got up on this little perch overlooking a Y junction in a road in the middle of this little town. Everything's quiet, dead quiet. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, of course. That's when Canadians play. And the first thing that happened is down the road came some troops on motorcycles. And they stopped at this little intersection and hopped out with their little wands. The next thing we hear is the rumble of tanks coming from the right. And it's a Dutch Leopard tank battalion. And it's the first squadron coming down the road, going a great raid on us. And they came down this road and they're waved through. And by the now, the lights are on in the village and everybody's out and they see this column of tanks roaring through their village. So everybody says, well, what's next? Well, within, at exactly the right interval down the other road, came the Canadian battalion, an infantry battalion. So they were moving a complete infantry battalion and an armored battalion, or regiment, linking them up together and moving them off to one flank of the Canadian brigade. And then we were going to start our advance. I mean, this is a pretty complicated thing to get two different nations, mm-hmm. an armored unit and an infantry unit, to mesh together on the move and move off to one flank and then immediately turn into an assault move.
Wow.
So we just watched in amazement as this is unfolded like clockwork. Squadron of armor, company of infantry, squadron of armor, company of infantry, squadron of armor, company. It just went on like this. And this thing just roared through town. And I looked at my boss and I said, that was pretty slick, wasn't it? Yes, it sure was. Then it was our turn. Then we had to get up and get ready to move. But everybody in this town saw it, watching it all happening, cheering. And then after everybody had gone through, lights went out and everybody went back to sleep again. And we carried on, and then the war started. So I think the origin of the question was reputation of
yeah.
Canadians. We had a reputation, and everybody else tried to live up to or keep up with the Canadians. The Dutch loved Canadians in the first place because it was Canadians that liberated Holland during the war, right? So for a Dutch armored battalion, as they call it, a regiment as we would call it, to be tacked onto the side of the Canadian Brigade, they just thought that we're really kings now. We're with the Canadians. And it was great to see that sort of reputation being fostered, maintained, that had been earned by troops before us. And it just kept going. It didn't matter whether we were in the north of Germany or in the south. We were, I think, better off in the north of Germany than we were in the south, simply because when we were in the south, we had to go a heck of a lot further to get into a deployment area, either American or German, than we were in the north. In the north, we were in it almost instantly. So we were that much better.
So do you want to tell me a little bit about the move from the north to the south and what that was like?
Yeah. We went into, how am I going to tackle this? I guess talk about the domestic situation, the impact on the families.
Sure.
It was traumatic because you not only had to leave an area of Germany that you had made a lot of friends in and you felt comfortable in and you were part of the German family, now we had to move into a totally different area. Germans didn't know us in the south. Canadians had never really been there other than the Air Force. Mm-hmm. We're a different animal than the Air Force. But we moved on to an air base around which there were a lot of married quarters already there. It had been a French place in the first instance, and then the Canadian Air Force had gone into it very, very briefly. And then as a consequence of the thinning out, one of the air dips came home, we went into their place. So the way to do this was to send so-called advance parties down to LAR, get them settled in, figure out where your unit was going to be garrisoned, what buildings were you going to take over for headquarters and company offices and all that sort of stuff? Where are you going to park all your vehicles? Where are you going to do store all of your ammunition? Where are you going to do all that stuff for the unit, getting it settled in? At the same time, the advance party is trying to figure out where all my family's going to live. So you were scouring all over the countryside, sorting out married quarters and German families that would take Canadians in on the economy, as it were, and getting all these things nailed down. So the only way, I because of what I was doing in the unit at the time, I was sent down as part of the advance party. But I couldn't take Eleanor and our new son with us. Mm-hmm. So, you go home. So she went back to Canada with our son, while I went down and did all this messing around, trying to figure out where we're going to be. And at the same time as we're trying to sort out where the unit was going to go and where the families were going to go, we were trying to make an impact with the local German population. Hey, we're from Canada. How do you like us so far? Sort of thing. And that's what we did. So that took about 3-4 months for that sort of process to go on. And then the units started moving down by road move from the North Germany all the way down to the South. So that was quite undertaking because you couldn't do it in a day. Mm-hmm. So you had to find marshalling areas where you could bring units down, put them off the side of the autobahns, let the troops sleep in their vehicles and set up field kitchens and all that sort of stuff, and then the next day carry on. Then you had to greet them, get them settled in, get the vehicles all parked up. And these guys are driving into an area of Germany that they'd never seen before. So it was all new. They're all trying to figure out, where does this road go? Where does that road go? And what's here? What's there? Where should we not go? And then once all the dust had settled, then we could bring the families down and get them squared away in their homes and things like that. So it was a tumultuous time frame for the brigade. At the same time, the politicians at the time had cut us badly, reduced our capability badly. And so there was a lot of anxiety within the brigade about whether or not we still had the support of Canadian government. Mm-hmm. Behind us. Well, of course, we found out soon enough that we didn't. Mm-hmm. That all they were attempting to do was get us the hell out of NATO if they could. Mm-hmm. So it was a tumultuous time for the families, a lot of upheaval, tumultuous time for the units and their capabilities, a lot of unhappiness about the new situation. We were nowhere near as happy a bunch of bandits in the south of Germany as we were in the north. In the north, we knew we were good, we were the right size, and in the south, we had been cut and sliced and hatched and cut apart, and it took us a long time to recover from that, I think. Yeah. And the equipment was starting to fail on us as well. So, of the 4 years I spent in Germany, 3 in the north and the last year in the south, 3 in the north were excellent. Mm-hmm. Yes, professionally and socially, for us as a young family, couldn't have been better. Great experience. But 1 year in the south was not a happy time for any of us, because we realized that the government that had been brought in at the time was doing its level best to gut the military, which they pretty much accomplished.
Now, did you notice any significant responses from other NATO troops to the downsizing of Force Sam Duty?
The only time I can remember having any discussion about it outside of Canadian circles was, I think, with the group of American officers when we went to our first American-based exercise area. Say, what, you know, what happened to you guys? How come? And that's where we got into a lot of discussions about political situation at the time in Canada and in the States. The States was trying to fight a war in Vietnam, and the troops in Germany had been left to rot pretty much as well. So Americans and Canadians at the time that I was in the south of Germany were not collectively a very happy bunch of troops. We were not happy about the way our government was treating us. Mm-hmm. Didn't understand that the reputation Canada had internationally was built in large part by on the backs of the military guys through two world wars and our involvement in NATO. We were able to sit at the tables of the world, sort of thing, as a power, with a voice, largely because of our ability to involve ourselves in NATO and be one of the NATO leaders. And that was being gutted and chopped and hacked without knowledge. It was pure ignorance on the part of the government at the time. You know, just had a leader that was anti-military. And he surrounded himself with a whole bunch of other people that were anti-military. They were, let's hold everybody's hand and, you know.
Now, that wasn't really an uncommon sentiment at the time. That was sort of at the height of sort of anti-Vietnam protests and
That's
all
right.
that kind of stuff. So
yeah, there's a lot of washover from that.
So how, I mean, it's... what was your perspective on that being a part of the military at that time?
Well, it was disheartening.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think any of us allowed it to affect us professionally. Mm-hmm. We got on with what we were tasked to do, and we still did a hell of a fine job, in my mind. And I think just about anybody you would care to speak to would say the same thing, that we still carried out our capabilities very, very well. But there was a lot of soul-searching going on within the Canadian military at the time. Your career, as you saw it, was being threatened by a bunch of politicians who didn't know or understand what it was that we were doing. So it was pretty tough. When I first went into the military, it was a proud career to get into, and you were challenged physically, mentally, and it was just something that you, this is good. You knew what the ultimate price could be, you know, but you knew and accepted that. That's part of the thing that you signed up for. But once we got down into LAR, that's when the start of the demise, I suppose, the start of the soul searching, the start of the scratching and clawing and distrust between the soldier, the bureaucrat, the politician, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody's looking over their shoulder all the time instead of just saying, charge. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, this is the way we're going. And there was a lot of, what are you here for? Are you here to cut me? Cut my platoon? Looking at bureaucrat bloggins or, you know, you'd get deployed to a UN post and you'd get all these politicians and superheroes in Canada coming to visit you, find out what you're doing, and lend support to the troops. Yeah, that was just a photo op as far as thing. I had very little good feelings toward visiting firemen that would come to visit me in Croatia or Golan Heights or wherever I was at the time. They were telling what we were doing. Clear off now. This is a dangerous area. You should leave now. Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, this is sort of when the rise of the term peacekeeping sort of came in. Was that brought?
Well, we've been at peacekeeping at the same time as we were in Germany. We've been doing these peacekeeping things in Gaza, the Gaza Strip, and Sinai, and things like that. And then we start to get into it more and more and more with on the Golan Heights, and then later into Croatia and Bosnia. Peacekeeping turned to peacemaking sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of fish. And now we're in Afghanistan, which is... it's a war.
Yeah.
No, it's not... it's peacemaking at its ultimate height, you know. You know who the bad guys are, you think. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they don't sort of wear uniforms, so you're not sure what you're up against. Yeah.
Right. Well, could you maybe tell me, we've talked a little bit about marital status. You were married by the time you went over,
yep.
correct?
Yep.
And had your first son while you were there. Now, did your wife return to Canada? Did she eventually come back to Germany?
Oh, yes. Sorry, I meant to say yes. So for the 3 or 4 months that I was down in Lahr sorting out accommodation and things like that, she was back in Canada, living with her mother and visiting all the relatives and in-laws, and everybody's oohing and aahing over our son. And then I was assigned a married quarter, because that was the first thing you could get into.
Okay.
So I was assigned, you will take this married quarter. Okay, when can I get it? We're going to have to wait because the new base commander is living in your married quarter until he gets his place all squared away. And that turned out to be kind of neat. There's a place in the north called Canada House, Maple Leaf House. It's where the commander of the Canadian garrison lived. And he, you know, was stocked with all kinds of special furniture and china and cutlery and stemware and all that sort of stuff. So when it was time for me, the new garrison commander in Lahr, who had been in the north, Colonel Sellers, called me in one day. He says, I suppose you'd like to get your married quarter pretty soon. I said, yes, sir, I would. I'd like to get the family put back together again. He says, yeah, I understand that. He says, okay, I'm going to move into the new Canada house on such and such a date. Here's the question. It's being stocked with all kinds of new furniture and stuff like that. Would you like the stuff that I brought down from the north to be left in the American quarter? I said, sure, if that's easy. That's fine. I didn't know what I was getting into, but I said, you know, let's keep it simple. So I said, sure, that's fine with me. If that's easy. So on the appointed day, I went over and I was marched into my married quarter. And here's all this furniture that's come out of Maple Leaf House in the north. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful furniture, and double the amount of china that I was entitled to. Double the stack, crystal glasses, beautiful silver knives and forks and stuff like this. He just left it all there. So I had the best equipped married quarter of anybody down there, and everybody would come over and have a visit with me, and they'd come in. You'd like to come and have a glass of port in my head? Yes, Jeff, that's very nice of you. And they'd come in and say, oh, this is quite elegant. How did you do this, Phillips? So it was a lot of fun in that respect. So when Eleanor finally got over to Lahr and took her into the home, she looked around and said, well, this is very, because all she had known to that point is that we'd been living on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of rough at some times. But now this place was palatial and palatially equipped in comparison. So it made her life with young Mark a lot easier, I suppose.
Yeah, it would. Now, did she work at all while she was in Germany?
No. She was a stay-at-home mom. And with a brand new son, that was just fine with me.
Sure. So what kind of activities would she have engaged in while there?
Well, they had things like wives clubs, and I think she enjoyed just getting out into the local villages and towns and walking around, pushing her son around in the trolley sort of thing, pram, and just enjoying the local scenery, shopping for little knickknacks. The nice thing about being in Germany was that if you weren't on exercise or training hard and that sort of stuff, you were on leave. We got extra leave while we were over there. They didn't want troops sitting around the garrison twiddling their thumbs. So they said, okay, if you're not off practicing for war, we want you on leave and rekindling yourself. So we spent a lot of time traveling all over Europe, you know, skiing and Switzerland and Austria and stuff like that, or traveling to Holland and Norway and Sweden and all these places, or over to the UK. A lot of time traveling around, being a tourist in Europe. It was, you know, that part of it was really good. But she didn't get involved in any sort of the book reading clubs and all that sort of. She's never been one to do that. I don't blame her, frankly. So, you know, she just got out and walked. She must have walked miles and miles and miles while she was over there.
Walking's a big thing in Germany.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah. And the Germans like it if they see you walking and pushing your son around. They say, oh, a good Canadian wife there.
Excellent. Yeah. So what was a typical day like for you, or was there such a thing as a typical day?
Not really. Usually at work, by 7 o'clock in the morning sort of thing, and leaving by 4 or 5 o'clock to go home. And the time that you were in garrison, you were preparing to go out of garrison. You were preparing your equipment, overhauling, studying tactics. There was a lot of liaison activities between yourself and the units that you supported. You know, like if you knew that your platoon was going to support a Patricia battle group for the most part, when you deployed, then you'd go and meet the battalion officers. They would know you. You would know them. You'd talk about how it was that you were going to support them, right down to the nitty-gritties of what your little field nightlights looked like. Nightlight is something that's just set on the side of the road. If you're hiding in some trees someplace, you leave a little light, a can, a black can, with a number punched out in holes, and inside you have a little candle sort of thing. So somebody driving along, and they look over and they see a little nightlight, and they see a number on it. They say, oh, well, somewhere in there is 1st Battalion PBCLI sort of thing. Takes me back to a bit of one of the... I'm going to go right back to unit training here, or individual training. When I was... The last thing I had to do as an officer cadet, and they knew that I was going to go off to a field unit, they said, we're going to train you on motorcycles. You're going to... There, you should be a dispatch rider. You might be. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I got to be trained on motorcycles, which was great experience. I went off to the unit in Winnipeg, and very shortly after I got there, off we went to this big, huge exercise in Wainwright. And the CO turned to me and says, okay, young Mr. Phillips, here's your motorcycle. I'd like you to ride all around Wainwright, get used to the layout, the land. And it, when the exercise starts and we tell you to go to this side or the other place, you'll know generally where it is. Okay, good. So I spent the first week of my time in Wainwright riding all over the place on my motorcycle by myself. I just had a great time. And as I rode around, I would see a field of wheat. Mm-hmm. And I'd look at my map and say, okay, if I go across that field, I'm going to get from this route to another route over there. So that's a nice shortcut. So you'd try it. You'd go through it in the daytime, and you go through this wheat field, wheat up here. Eyes are driving on your mic. I says, this is cool. Got to the other side. There's a route. Okay, so you tuck that in the old hamburger fed computer. So I remember that. Sure enough, the war started, and I was dispatched off to the brigade headquarters because everything was done on radio silence. You didn't want to give your secrets away. So all the units would send dispatch riders to the headquarters. And then you were given your dispatch bag. Okay, there. Young Bluggins, take this satchel of orders over to 1st Battalion PPCLI. Do you know where they are? Yes, sir, I sure do. Okay, carry on. And you roar off, and of course it's in the night, so you don't have any lights on. You're on your motorcycle, but you've been around. So I said, I'm trying to be so. I can go through that field. I went through there just the other day. So I get to the point, I go screeching off across this field on my motorcycle. But what I didn't realize, that before I... Between the time that I'd gone through there and now in the middle of the night, a squadron of tanks had gone. They moved through there. I couldn't see that, but soon found out because the bike like this. Suddenly the bike was going that way, and I went this way.
Oh, no.
Crash. I can't. I knocked myself out. And I woke up a little while later. I looked around and looked at the bike. The front forks of the bike had been bent, so I couldn't ride the bike anywhere. So I had to walk out.
Oh, no.
So I walked out, staggered out, got onto the road, walked down the road, and now I'm looking for this little nightlight I was telling you about. And I see the nightlight. I said, okay, they're in there. So I start going up this little trail in the woods, and suddenly I hear, hop. So I stopped. and they give me the first word of the password. I can't remember what it was. Let's say it was Big Joke. So the guy said, advance. So I give you the hands up, you advance. He said, big. And I said, I have no idea. I have no idea what the password is. Stand still. And he came out, and our flashlights had little red lenses on them, so you're not showing light all over the place. So I put the light up to my face, and all he said was, holy shit, what happened to you? And I said, bike accident. He said, yeah, you don't look good. No, I feel very good. Come with me. So he marched me into where the CP was, and I handed over my satchel. And the duty officer was very annoyed that I was late getting him his orders. And then he took a look at me, he said, all right, turned to Corporal Bloggins, who just marched me into the end of his bayonet, said, get him over to the MIR. And I guess I smashed my face up pretty well, so I was all blood and dirt and goo. And so that was my first experience as a dispatch rider. That goes back to the story of what these little nightlights are.
Yeah.
If the nightlight wasn't there, I'd be wandering up and down that street, right still. That was a good experience.
Crazy. All right, well, back to Germany. What was your favorite pastime when you weren't working?
Travel.
Traveling?
Yeah, travel. A lot of, I think, 80% of our travel in Europe resulted in skiing.
Okay.
We'd go on ski trips. Or we'd go to a country that we just wanted to go to visit, Holland. We'd go spend 2 weeks in Holland. Or 2 weeks in Spain or something like that. But a lot of it was skiing. We love to ski. So we'd go to all the big places like Kitzbühel and St. Anton and Zermatt and places like that. So it was wonderful. That was straightforward, pretty simple.
Yeah. So while you were serving there, what do you feel was the most significant contribution for CMGP made to Western Germany or Europe in general?
Well, I think we were part of a much larger force, NATO.
Mm-hmm.
We played our part. Canada played its part in keeping the peace, as it were, in ensuring that the bad guys, if they looked across the border, and if they were at all tempted to make a run for Europe, that it was going to be a very costly enterprise. So we did our part to ensure that when they looked across the border, that they say, I don't think we should do that. So as an individual, I felt I was part of a very good organization that had a significant role to play in world peace at the time. I mean, these are not sort of thoughts that a young officer or soldier in a brigade in Germany would think of very often. He's more interested in the what's immediately in front of them, his day-to-day undertakings.
Yeah.
But if you started to think about the big picture, you realized that you were part of something pretty significant. The reputation that we as Canadians made with the Germans that we lived with at the time was good. Germans, when we were in the north of Germany, Germans would love to come and watch Canadians play hockey. I mean, we had a hell of a good hockey league. Every unit had a hockey team. And some guys were posted to Germany and stayed there simply because they were good hockey players. But it was a really, really good, tough hockey between the units. And we had arenas set up. And every fort, every garrison had a big arena. Just the first thing, I can remember landing in Dusseldorf and traveling by bus out to my unit. Being met with by a really good chum of mine who'd arrived there, I guess maybe a couple of months before I did. And he grabbed me as I got off the bus. He said, come on, we're going to the hockey game. Okay. I'm not even into my quarters yet. He said, we're going off to a hockey game. And I remember walking into this arena, and it was packed. Canadians cheering, and the team of the game hadn't even started yet. And there was just this atmosphere. Wow. This is pretty cool. And he says, hey, wait till the hockey game starts. And then I looked around and said, these don't all look like soldiers. He says, oh, no, there's whole bunch of soldiers here from each of the two units, but the rest of them are all Germans, so the local Germans. They come in, they just love it. And then he says, "Oh, there's our CO. Come on, I'll introduce you." So the name of the CO was Jazz W. Duncan, big man, who had Korean experience.
Okay.
And big, tall guy, and he was a hunter, fisherman kind of guy. In fact, he was the president or whatever of the local rod and game club. And he had this little German hat on his head, you know, with a little feather sticking out of it, a little mm-hmm. felt hat, hunter's hat. So I went over, and this guy looked around and says, "O'Brien, how are you tonight?" Fine, sir. Let me introduce B.J. Phillips, who's one of your new platoon commanders. "Oh, good evening." And O'Brien looked and he says, "You're pretty big with that hat in your head, don't you, sir?" And Duncan looked at him, and he looked at me, a little smile on his head, took the hat off, says, "Am I any smaller now, Mr. O'Brien?" "No, sir, you're just as tall as you ever were." So that was my introduction to Jazz Duncan, a hell of a fine officer. And I still talk to him now. He lives in Kelowna. Talk to him all the time. Good guy. Great guy.
So, what are your lasting impressions of the time you spent before
CMGB? Good ones. I guess mixed, but between the north and south of Germany. But 90% of what I remember of my time in Germany is all good. Great soldiers to serve with. Hell of a fine attitude about they were positive. It was just a big positive experience. And you were part of it, so it was exciting and it was challenging, and you were pushed to your physical limits. You know, you'd go for 48, 72 hours without sleeping to meet some of the requirements, sort of thing. You know, you're just dragging yourself around, but you know, that was part of the game. For the family, it was a great experience. I mean, we still talk about our time in Germany like it happened yesterday, sort of thing.
Wow.
So it was a very positive experience. The last part of it, not so much. You know, we were struggling when we got down to Lyre, simply because of the feeling of being let down a little bit, being knifed by the people that you hopefully you wanted to trust, because mm-hmm. you'd voted the bastards in.
Yeah. Okay. Do you feel there was anything particularly unique about this mission?
Well, there was no other place like it, as far as a Canadian soldier aspired to go and serve in Germany, because that's where the operational levels were the highest, that's where the training, the pace of life was the highest. So there was no other service like it. I mean, you could go off on a UN tour, and that's fine. That could be challenging in its own right, but to be part of large army formation that was good. There was no other life like it. There was no life like it. Where did that come from? Very positive experience. Wouldn't have traded it for anything.
Have you returned to Germany at all since?
Yep. Not to live in Germany, but some years later I was sent off on what they call an exchange tour, where I became a member of the British Army for period of time, and we were stationed in the UK, and on a holiday time frame, we hopped in the car, Mark, and by then our daughter, Kimberly, and we went off for a holiday trip through Germany, driving around, went to Zost, where we started off, and tramped around all the old, looked at where we'd lived before, and we're telling Mark, "This is where you were born, in British Military Hospital," and whatnot. Went down to Lahr. Went out into Kaltop to see if we could figure out, remember where we used to live in this little village up in the woods, and found it. So I said, "Well, I wonder if they're still there." So we parked the car and went up to the door and knocked on the door. And sure enough, she, Lottie, came to the front door. And it was almost instantaneous. Tears just instantly came from her face. And she stepped out smiling. We just hugged. And, And by that end, by that time, Eleanor and Mark and Kim are standing at the steps, and she looked around, and she just blinked. She recognized Eleanor right away, and then she saw Mark, who by this time is kind of strapping on Kala. She says, "That's his Mark," because all she remembered was this little baby basket sort of thing. And so she just, again, crying. And so she said, come in. So we went in, and one of the dogs was still there. Mm-hmm. The husband wasn't. Herr Han, as I used to call him, had died, unfortunately, about 2 years before we came back to visit. So it was sad that he wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Just a quick aside, when you're living on the economy, you paid your monthly rent in cash, German marks, right? And you had a little book, but solid book it was called. And so you put your 400 marks or whatever it is that you're paying in the middle of your book, and you go and you knock on the door at the appropriate evening after dinner. And for them, it was an occasion. And I was ushered into their place with great friendliness and formality. And I was told to sit in the chair and at the foot of the fire, and the dog would come and curl up your feet, and out would come the white wine. And, 4 hours later, you'd stagger back up to your room. So I paid the rent, honey. It was just really a pleasant experience to have to pay rent, because it turned into this grand discussion. I don't know how I could talk 4 hours with a couple in my very, very limited broken German and their very, very limited broken knowledge of English. But for 4 hours, we could carry on a conversation about the Canadian Shield and hunting bears in Canada. And it's just amazing couple. But yeah, we got back to Germany, and that was a visit that we will long remember. Even Mark remembers this woman, who knew him as a little baby, and her reaction to seeing him again.
Yeah.
That was good. It's good.
It sounds like you've had some wonderful experiences over there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did. We did. Memories that have lasted a lifetime. And as I said, quite often we'll talk of our time in Germany with other friends that were there at the same time. And it's just like we were there yesterday. 11th of November. I went to a service here, but I was watching the national service on TV a little later in the evening, and sure enough, there's one of my friends, O'Brien, being interviewed about UN operations. But he and I were in Germany at the same time together, and we formed a friendship that has... He is my best friend through the military, and it's lasted all these years from our time together in Germany. And before that, in Camp Borden, these friendships just go on forever, but a lot of it's centered on the crazy things we did in Germany, which I won't tell you about. A lot of fun times, crazy times.
Thank you very much for sharing your memories.
Pleasure, Christina. Pleasure.
I definitely appreciate it.
Yeah.